The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
We are joined by David McWilliams. His new book is out. It is called The Greatest Story Ever Sold. It is the full title, Money, The Greatest Story Ever Sold. And it looks exactly at that, the history of money from the point at which people scratched on bones to remember who owed who what, all the way through up to cryptocurrency. David is with us this morning. David, how are you?
I am in great form, Anton. In great, great form. It's lovely to be here. And yeah, the book is published today after couple of years, let's say more than a couple of years working away.
It is a fabulous piece of work. Fabulous piece of work, highly entertaining, and it treats very difficult, not difficult, but quite challenging esoteric topics, and it does them with a breezy ease. Now, last week I was talking to a man who was going to be conducting an orchestra of MGM hits, and one of them was theme tunes from The Wizard of Oz, and I said to the man, am I right in saying that The Wizard of Oz was an allegory for the gold standard? As I'm reading your book about midway through, there is a chapter dedicated to the sheer complexity of that allegory.
Yeah.
Explain The Wizard of Oz and how it's linked to money.
The Wizard of Oz, the yellow brick road in The Wizard of Oz is the gold standard, the yellow bricks of gold. Okay. Dorothy in The Wizard of Oz is from Kansas. Kansas is the state which is smack in the middle of the United States, and she is regarded as, she is representative of the average American person, you know, middle America. The straw man is the American farmer. The tin man is American industry. The Emerald City is Wall Street. Okay. Emerald City, the green from the dollar. Okay. And the Wizard of Oz is this banker who is orchestrating everything behind the scenes. The Wicked Witch of the West is this movement of farmers and populace and rural movement coming out of the West. Not the West as in California, but the Midwest, which was the heartland of the United States. So the story is amazing when I came across it, right? What happened if in 1896, and this is esoteric, there was the last election of the 19th century in the United States between the Democrats, the Republicans, and a party called the Populists. And the Populists were a movement, a rural movement, that wanted the United States to abandon using gold as the anchor for the currency and use silver. Now, why do they want to do that? Because there's more silver around and it's cheaper. So if you abandon gold, you can print more money. And why did they want to print money? They wanted to print money because there was an enormous agricultural recession in the United States. And anybody who's in agriculture, farmers listening to this will know that agriculture and farmers are always need to go into debt because they sow, they get no money until they reap. So there's a period of no money. So the farmers were in debt in the United States and they owed that money in gold. But the price of cereal was falling and grains and agriculture. Why? Because the Americans were expanding the railways. So they were expanding enormously the amount of land under farming. And agricultural output in the United States was going through the roof. And the issue is, so that's the background noise. And there's lots of stuff about the Civil War and all that sort of stuff. But the allegory was written by a guy called Frank L. Baum. And it was called The Wonderful Wizard of Oz. And of course, it was published in Aden, I think 1902 or something like this, right? But in the 1930s, MGM introduced Snow White, which was the first ever cartoon or children's story for the big screen. And this did a fortune for them. And they said, hold on a second, children's stories can work. And they found The Wonderful Wizard of Oz, which was basically an allegory about money and the gold standard, which had been sold as a children's story. And they put it on. And of course, it was the first Technicolor movie ever. Now, so that's the story.
This is the other thing that I thought was fascinating when it comes to the US economy, because I was aware that there was a big debate about whether or not the US currency should peg to gold or whether it should peg to silver and the shift to being a fiat.
Talking about the gold standard at 11 o'clock in the morning.
Who knew that it originally pegged to Spanish silver?
Yes.
And that functioned as US currency with the dollar?
Well, the dollar, the word dollar comes from Thaler, which means valley in German. A Thal, you know, Joachim's Thal, Rosenthal. And Thaler came from a place called Joachim's Thal, which means basically Johnny's Valley, John's Valley, which was in Czechoslovakia, what's now the Czech Republic. And they found an enormous amount of silver in the 15th century, 16th century, massive silver mining. And of course, then they printed these silver coins. And these silver coins were known as Thaler, coins from the valley. And of course, over years and years, thaler became dollar. Okay, so that's the word for it. The second word is that the Spaniards were the people who basically owned the monetary standard from the time they went to Latin America until about the 19th century. And again, why was that? Because they found enormous deposits of silver. So there was a currency called the real, which you will know is still used in Brazil and in the Arab countries. So the currencies are still called reals, right? And this was the standard, the silver currency.
And that's from royal, isn't it?
From the Spanish word for royal. So it was basically the royal, it was the king's mint, right? And the American Republicans, so George Washington, all those guys, were always using these Spanish currencies because the Spanish currencies were coming up from Mexico. We kind of forget that the history of Mexico and the history of the United States are so intertwined. But when the Americans got independence, they were going to use the real, but deep in the DNA of the American, even the American revolutions, they were British, like the Washingtons and the Hamiltons, right? And in their tradition, Spain was the enemy. So they said, we cannot call the new currency of the United States, which is an English-speaking, essentially Protestant country, after a Spanish Catholic king. So we've got to figure out another way. We call it dollar after the thaler. And that's where it came from.
Now, this goes to the significance of money when it comes to things like international conflict. You mentioned the thaler coming from Germany. One of the things that I had never known about was you detail the Nazi plan to use counterfeiting.
That's a mad story.
As a way to win the Second World War.
Yeah, so basically, Hitler, if you think about Adolf Hitler lived through and profited from the hyperinflation Weimar Germany. So when the German middle class were destroyed, the Nazis offered a alternative ideology, right? And so he understood more than almost anybody else the awesome destructive power of money when you destroy it. So one of the themes in the book is that money is an essential anchor for our societies. So all societies that have used, so we've had, like, let's say, feudal societies, we've had religious-based societies, we've had communist nirvanas, all these ways of organising society, they're all gone by the wayside. The one that remains is society anchored around this thing called money. So that's the one that keeps the 7 billion people in the world ticking over. That's it, right? And Hitler understood, look, if we destroy money, we don't just destroy inflation or what economists call, we mess with people's heads, because money is a psychological anchor that allows us to make sense of this incredibly complex world. So after the Battle of Britain, I think in 1941, Hitler said, we can't beat these British with bombs, but maybe we can beat them with money. So what they did, which is an extraordinary, the world's largest ever forgery, equivalent to 7 billion sterling today, £4 in every 10 that was in circulation in England was forged in a concentration camp called Sachsenhausen. And it was forged over an 18-month period. And it's an extraordinary story. So Hitler, under Himmler, sent out this request for printers, for dyers, for mathematicians, for all sorts of people involved in fine painters involved in the forgery business. And they got 123 desperate men. They took them out of Auschwitz. They took them out of Treblinka. It's a business historian. And they put them in Sachsenhausen. And their job was to break the Bank of England, to figure out what the Brits were using. And again, of course, we forget now because sterling isn't such a strong currency. But in the 1940s, it was the world's premier currency. And the way in which they executed the forgery was the following. They sent a guy to Switzerland with the forged notes, a pretend, inverted commas, industrialist, who'd said, look, I just got these in the black market. I want to see if they're actually straight up. The Swiss bankers got out their big high-powered lamps and whatever, and they figured out, okay, these are real sterling, even though they'd been forged. And then he doubled down. This is all true. And he said, look, I'm still nervous. Can you send them to the Bank of England to make sure the serial numbers are right? So the Swiss bankers sent a batch to the Bank of England, and the Bank of England says, yes, these are real. So then the news came back to Germany that, yes, they're real, and they printed. And of course, the plan was in 1941 to drop this money out of airplanes over England, to drop it like money falling from the sky. And Hitler's assumption was that most English people would just trouser a few quid and say, look, say nothing, and then go to the Bank of England. Or think. But by 1943, the war situation had changed. The Luftwaffe couldn't spare the planes because they were losing in Russia. But they still had the money. So they think, what are we going to do with it? And then a whole black market emerged in the last 2 years of the Second World War of in paintings, in art, and everything. All the passports to Argentina that were bought by the senior Nazis were bribed with this sterling. And finally, Mussolini was kidnapped by... So Mussolini lost power in Italy. The Italians had him. They were going to give him back to the Allied powers. The Germans bribed Italian officials with this fake money to get Mussolini out. So it's an amazing story. And then after the war, the Bank of England was so worried about these forgeries, because they were all over the place, that they retired all £5 notes in the world and issued new ones. So it's an amazing... And the whole story is money has just been part of our world for so long.
And this is the what's equally fascinating is you detail how money, when it is counterfeit, can be used to win and lose wars. But you also talk about how dangerous it can be even when it's functioning. You assert in the book that possibly one of the reasons the Roman Empire fell was currency problems.
Yes.
And you go through the challenges that Holland had in relation to tulips and the capacity for credit to make things go bad.
Well, I mean, the Roman Empire one is really fascinating, because I read a book. I mean, when you're doing a book like this, you just end up lucky. You see, what I've always wanted to do is take economics out of the straitjacket of economics and add history, add fiction, add anthropology, add biology, add evolution, all these things that go up, because the book is about the relationship between humans and this extraordinary technology called money, and I describe it as a technology. So it means you're doing all sorts of you're doing all sorts of things. But you go back to the Roman Empire. There was an exhaustive study done about 8 years ago, which said that there were 219 reasons offered by historians as to why the Roman Empire collapsed. Right? Okay, sociological ones, military ones, blah blah blah. But one thing that was never offered was the following, which was that in the final years of the Roman Empire, when I say the final years, the final century, right? Because these things happen very slowly. In the same way as the Roman Empire emerged slowly, it ended slowly. The Roman emperors debased their currency so much. So they basically took silver and gold out of the coin and they put in copper and all sorts of lead and Mickey Mouse stuff, right? Okay? In order to print more money. They so destroyed the coin that at the end, only the emperor's face could only be printed on one side of the coin, because the coins were so brittle. So there was so little metal in them, precious metal in them, right? And if you look at even references to banking and the banking system, which have been really ubiquitous in Roman history, this disappeared towards the end of the 3rd century into the 4th century. So what it looks, and also what it showed, that Roman merchants in the very final end were taking real stuff, not money. So I would sell you something and you'd say, I'll give you 10 cows, or I'll give you a vat of wine.
Oh, we'll barter right? around it.
Yeah, because that's what happens when money loses its value. People say, look, I'm not accepting that as real money, but I'll give you this, as in real stuff, wine or land or whatever. So it struck me that maybe, just maybe, one of the reasons the Roman Empire collapsed was because the technology that anchored it, which is money, was debased, degraded and undermined to such an extent that the society collapsed around it.
Now, this is one of the great successes of the book, because it is soaring in its ambition in what it covers. We literally go back to prehistory, to the Roman Empire and up to modern times. While we're talking about debasing currency, you should bring us close to home, because you talk about Ireland's experience of this in the 1990s and yes, how wedded we were back then to the Brits.
Yes, well, this comes out, I suppose, like it's a, I mean, Anton, I started my career as a professional monetary economist in the central bank here. And then I went on to work in an investment bank. And then I came back and, you know, as you know, got into journalism and documented the boom. But there was always this thing, even the last 30 years in Ireland, was like our relationship with money, with currency, credit and what have you. So when I was in the central bank many, many years ago, in the winter of 1992, there was a currency crisis, a massive, massive currency crisis. So much so. So what had happened was the British and ourselves were in a exchange rate regime that we both followed the German mark. So we were in effect pretending to be Germans. That's it, right? And that doesn't last very long. And then the British had a thing called Black Wednesday. Sterling collapsed. The British. So basically what happened was the British were suffering the hangover, as we all now know in Ireland, of a credit and property boom in the late 80s, right? So when you have a credit and property boom, the thing that you really need is you need interest rates to fall and fall rapidly. But because they were tied to the Germans and the Germans had reunification, their interest rate rose. So British interest rate went up and they said, okay, hold on a second. We need to leave this currency. Now, at the time, the whole world believed that Ireland was so dependent on Britain that we couldn't operate our own currency and we should devalue at the same time as sterling. And that created a massive crisis here. And as I say in the book, was most visually represented by miles and miles of queues outside Sainsbury's in Newry of Irish people buying cheap beer in Britain before the Irish currency collapsed. So the way in which you actually got ahead of the currency was you bought beer, right? Now the point, and that's a very legitimate thing to do, but economists don't talk about these things. I always thought visually this was the most interesting. But fascinatingly, that was 30 years ago. Now we had Brexit and it hardly made a difference, you know, in terms of policy here, right? We worried about it, but there was no sense that Ireland was going. And that is the story of Ireland. So in the 1970s, and 80s, Ireland probably did around half of our exports to the UK. Today, it's 11%. So it shows the massive decoupling between Ireland and Britain.
And that's one of the things that I enjoyed immensely about the book is all of the things that could be esoteric are brought down to the layman's experience of it.
Toyota Corollas full of cans of stag.
And also you are very complimentary about the capacity of we the masses to predict and cope with monetary changes and get ahead of the system without even knowing it in some instances. Where you finish is with the most modern of currencies. You talk about Sam Bankman-Fried, you talk about cryptocurrency, you talk about Bitcoin, and you sound a fairly significant warning.
Yeah, I mean, one of the key points in the book is that over thousands of years, one of the essential arguments has been between private money and public money. Now, what I make the point is that money is always public, right? Real money is always public, issued by the state or an agent of the state. Private money, okay, as in cryptocurrency, can only enrich those people who print the money. And if Anton Savage had Anton Savage coin and you print it, and who'd get rich? Anton. You would actually get rich if you think about it, right? So at the core of the monetary system is the idea that money is as much part of the state as the Gardaí are, as the Irish Army is, as the tax system is, right? This is the state. You cannot divorce money from the state. Why? Because as Hitler figured out, it's too important.
Yet we are told that cryptocurrency achieves exactly that and is democracy and currency form.
Cryptocurrency is lots of things, but it's not currency and it's not money. It is a speculative asset that goes up, goes down. All, like, as I said in the book, look, I'm not giving people financial advice. If you want to buy crypto, away you go. But don't tell me it's money. Because if you tell me it's money, you don't understand money.
The book, I assume, must have been a huge amount of work because, as you said, you are incorporating biology, sociology, history into aspects of money and detailing all of money and you're footnoting all of it as you go through. It must have been years of work,
It's a child of the pandemic, let's say. No, it's a product of it. No,
the rest of us did sourdough. Look, you produced this.
I suppose, I've been thinking about writing this book for about 20 years, right? You know, because I was always intrigued. You know, this is what happened when we sat in this studio years ago and said, look, I think the banks are overlending. I think property is going through the roof. Before 08, it was all about money. I mean, what I've always thought, Anton, is that when economists see a price going up, they see a number. When people see a price going up, we get a feeling, right? So money is psychological. And it changes the way we think about the world. So when house prices were going up in Ireland, or are still going up in Ireland, people get a feeling. It's not, they don't see the price. They get a sort of slightly euphoric feeling because money affects the way we think about the world. So for many years, I've been thinking about how do you explain this? How do you explain the psychology of money? What I call the trippiness of money in the book, right? And how do you explain that? And how do you get people to appreciate and understand what actually this thing is. So, yes, it's a huge amount of work, but it probably was a long time in the making, even before I sat down to write it.
Well, it is a great end result. The book is called Money, The Greatest Story Ever Sold. A text asking, is it available on Audible?
It's available on Audible. If you can put up with me yakking on for a few hours, you can definitely do it. But And it's in bookshops all over Ireland from this morning.
Really appreciate. And in how many languages?
17.
Fair play. It is a highly entertaining. David, thank you very much for coming in.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance.
Weekdays at 9 a.m. on News Talk.